ABC Radio, it's Nightlife with Sarah McDonald.
Well, how we are formed as people and individuals is very much dependent about where we grew up and who we grew up with. Our families, they have such a profound influence on us, don't they? Many Australians, of course, will seek help at some stage in their life from counsellors and therapists to talk about their life and their problems and to try and solve them. But we are not just individuals, and a really important place to start solving problems is to look at the whole family structure and the individuals within that structure and how it works together. So often involving the whole family in therapy can be the best way to get to the heart of any problems and find ways to solve them. So we thought we'd talk about systematic family therapy on Nightlife tonight. We have an expert in the studio to do just that. Jacqueline McDermott has a private practice in Sydney, and she's a lecturer in this field. She's spent the last two decades helping individuals, couples and family with a range of complex issues, and she joins us now on Nightlife to talk about this. Hello, welcome to the show.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming in. So why is this method of therapy called systematic? What does it mean by systematic family therapy?
Systemic.
Ah, systemic, is it? Right.
Meaning that we all belong to a group, or so we look at the system as opposed to the individual in isolation. So right. there's a shift from looking at somebody with a problem that's just within them to a problem that's sort of shared with their family group or maybe their wider community.
Right, because we're all just so much a product of the system that within which we operate.
Yes, we don't operate in isolation. We're affected by other people. People are affected by our behaviours and the ways that we communicate. So we can't sort of stay in isolation.
Is this a new way of helping people, looking at systemic family therapy, or has this gone on for some time?
It's gone on for a long time. Actually, the first person who was a founder in systemic family therapy was Alfred Adler. And he was around, he died in the late 1930s. So that's how long ago, you know, this he started. He was the first person. And then it kind of went through, I guess it was pretty quiet, male-dominated field. And then in the 60s it became big again with Murray Bowen. And on from that, it's a big part of the field.
Yeah. And it's evolved somewhat. Yeah. We'll talk about Murray Bowen a bit. But what sort of cases do you see when you do family therapy? Who comes in your doors?
I see lots of different things. I do adult family groups. That might be with somebody who's had a cutoff from a family member, usually a parent or a child, like an adult child. Sometimes I see family groups where there's teenagers who's self-harming or suicidal or eating disorder, that kind of thing. Other times I'll see families where there's maybe they've separated or they're struggling with that separation. There's children who have maybe ADHD or autism or anxiety showing signs of behavioural problems. So there's quite a wide range of problems that come in the door for a family therapist. Mm.
Is it hard to get people in the door? Because I'm imagining that for parents, straight away, they're automatically feeling guilty when they walk in that door. Am I to blame? If there's something wrong with my child, or they're having issues about coping in the world, or they have got an eating disorder or something, they're automatically thinking, are you just going to blame me this whole hour that we've got together?
I think a lot of parents do worry about that when they come through the door. They automatically think they've failed, they've done something wrong. But we don't think about them in those terms. We again look at the whole system and what's happened to those parents and where they are today, what's happened in previous generations and so on. So there's never one person to blame for anything that we see.
Because no one's in isolation.
No one's in isolation.
And are the parents very much a product of the family that they grew up in?
Yes, usually they are. You know, communication patterns travel across time through generations. Mm. Trauma travels through generations. So there can be lots of reasons why people end up where they are.
Yeah. Well, that's true, isn't it? That intergenerational trauma thing that's been very much investigated through the World War wars and how they've gone through families. And we're understanding so much more about that now, aren't we?
Definitely, and we can still see that today. When I look at a genogram, which is a family tree in layman's terms, then I look to see what's happened in previous generations with trauma and wars and those kind of things. And I can see how the trauma's affecting, you know, future generations.
Even if they don't know about it?
Even if they don't know about it. So there can be secrets that are held. The way that people come together with intimacy, perhaps, or being able to share feelings, you know, those sort of things manifest from trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So
is that one of the first things that you do? You draw up like this little family tree?
One of the first things that we're taught to do is to do a genogram, which is a family tree, and thus you have to know how to do that quite quickly. And so I gather lots of information first up, you know, who's in your family, you know, who are your grandparents, how did you communicate your feelings? How did you deal with conflict in the, you know, the place that you grew up in? Whereabouts are you from? Because, of course, these days people are from all over the world.
Mm.
So there can be cultural differences, and how do people come together with that, and how do they manage that? So I'm asking all of those kind of curious questions. I get curious about people, and that means that people give me a lot of information. And then I can see patterns and start to map out the work.
Yeah, with the patterns.
Yeah.
I mean, with culture, that's an interesting one because we live in a world which is so much more mobile and so much intermarrying between cultures as well. And there's, can you make generalisations about how different cultures deal with things that would impact on a family system and how it operates?
Oh, it's hard to make a generalisation, but certainly I do see these days a lot of problems in relationships where people have come from very different cultural backgrounds, and they're trying to bring them together and then perhaps bring children into that.
Mm.
And even displacement or people who, you know, for whatever reason comes into that as well.
Yeah, that's right. So you've got therapy. It's not just about in isolation, it's about how someone's interconnected to all the people within their family. That's basically the priority of what you do.
Family therapists look at problems that exist between people as opposed to what's within people. So traditional psychotherapy is about problems within people as opposed to what we look at between people.
Right. Yeah. And do you think that there's some issues that are best suited to one or the other?
There are definitely some issues where you do need to see an individual therapist to do the work that's happening, what's going on for you personally. And then there are other times that a family therapist is needed because it's a systemic issue, meaning it's not a problem that's within a person necessarily. It's about the interactions around them.
And how does someone know that? Like, how do they know it's something that's going on around them and it's within the family as opposed to something that's uniquely theirs that they've developed in their way of dealing or responding to the world?
I think this is probably the biggest challenge for people to know, you know, what sort of help do I need to get and where do I go for that help these days? Sometimes they don't know it and they are at the point in their life where they have a child that's very unwell or acting out in quite an extreme way. It might be a school counsellor that says, look, you need to see a family therapist. It might be a teacher. It might be often it's an individual therapist who will say, this is family therapy. It's more, you need to go and find a family therapist or I will refer you. So I think a lot of people struggle with, you know, when do we go to a family therapist as opposed to sending little Johnny off, you know, to see somebody on his own.
Yeah. So you kind of basically seek the wisdom of others to decide that often.
Quite often.
Sounds like it. Mm.
Quite often I think people do, but there's lots of information out there about family therapy these days on the internet, so people do Google as well.
You're on Nightlife and we're talking about systemic family therapy and how a family impacts on how we deal with the world and issues that we can face. My guest tonight is a family therapist practice. She has a private practice. Her name is Jacqueline McDermott. So what were the origins of this? You mentioned how it first emerged way back in the 1930s, but what's the foundation it lays on today?
Well, there's about eight major approaches that feed into family therapy. And so it did start back in the 20s, and then it sort of there's been the Murray-Bowen influence, which happened around the 1960s, and then it sort of travelled through to postmodernist times.
Right. Let's just take the Bowen family therapy. What was the Bowen focus? Is that to do with the body as well?
His big focus was on working with the genogram.
Right.
So his whole body of work is around looking at patterns that travel through time. And he also talked about a concept called differentiation of self, which means the ability to be connected to others, but maintaining your own individuality with that. So being able to hold your own ideas without that emotional reactivity. So an example of that would be people who maybe have poor differentiation, according to Murray Bowen, would be people who have tantrums if they hear something they don't like and storm out or cut people off in the family. So Murray Bowen was very concerned with getting people to stay connected and hold your own ideas and that be okay.
Right, because we are so much of how who we are and the ideas we have are a product of where we come from, though, but we have to learn at a certain age to set ourselves free from that and take with from our family what we need and forge our own path. So can it be about not forging that path properly as we enter adulthood? Is that where things can go wrong?
I think that, well, it could be that, but it could be just that you're in a family where emotions are run very high and right. So people lead with their emotions as opposed to thinking about things, which is what he sort of talks about with differentiation. Mm.
It is amazing, isn't it, how you can often see patterns through generations that, I mean, even unconscious ones of people just doing the same thing that their mother did throughout a generation. And then that simple thing of like, oh my gosh, I'm becoming my mother.
That's right. Yes. Can't help it.
Yeah, well, a lot of that stuff we feel is almost inevitable. That's right. Just happens surreptitiously bit by bit till you wake up one day and go, I'm just doing the same thing. I couldn't stop it.
It's the communication stuff that travels, you know, that you can't help, you know, you can't help the fact that you're talking or you're connected to others in the same kind of way that previous generations have done it. So there can be symptoms of behaviours that we see in families, like affairs. For example, lots of, you know, when I look at a presentation when an affair's happened, then I can usually plot back in their genogram other members of the family who have also had affairs, because perhaps that's been a better way of managing stress as opposed to doing something different.
Right. I mean, a lot of people would wonder if that's sort of nature or nurture. Are we just repeating patterns or is it something genetic? We're predisposed to doing something like having affairs. Mm. What do you think?
I think that I don't think it's genetic. I think that people, you know, it's a bit of environment. It's what you pick up. It's how you manage your inner world.
Mm. Or a learnt behaviour. Yeah. You've seen that's a way of dealing with things and it worked for my family. Or as you said before, it can be subconscious. And that's when it's really freaky, isn't it? We can just carry on patterns that we didn't even know existed, really. Mm. So do people sometimes have aha moments when they realise they're doing that with you?
Absolutely. When I look at a genogram with somebody or I put it on the whiteboard, which I often do, people look at that and go, wow, like I didn't realise, of course, and the penny drops. And then they can start to move to make changes because they're very conscious about their behaviours and they're looking at previous generations. And often they want something very different for their children. So this is the opportunity to do something.
To break those patterns so they parent differently and have a different system that they set up.
Mm.
Right. It's hard work though, yeah?
Very hard work. Yeah. It's not easy because, of course, we quickly want to revert back to those behaviours. So as much as it's...
Because they come naturally, right?
It's like all of us, when we get together with our family that we've come from, we start to behave like we did when we were kids. And how many of us sort of go, oh, I wish I'm not going to behave like that. But you meet your parents and you think, gosh, here I am behaving like this teenager again.
Yeah. It's like that whole Christmas thing. You go over and you go, I'm not going to fall into that pattern this year. I'm going to be different. But you do as soon as you get in there. So do you think that we all have roles in families?
Absolutely.
It's like the peacemaker and the troubled one and the... Does that ring true? Yeah.
Yes, yes. So Murray Bowen is, again, big on roles that people play. So the peacemaker is one role which you're talking about. An angry person, you know, like, you know, if you're the angry person in a family, you tend to be the angry person everyone else can relax around you. But if the angry person suddenly decides not to be angry anymore, then usually somebody takes over from that.
Well, everyone would be very confused and then steps into that breach, do they?
They step in to try, or they feel confused about the fact that there's been this big change. So humans don't like change very much, and they struggle with that whole idea of, okay, we want something different, but how do we make these behavioural changes and feel settled by it?
And so to do that, I mean, is that really hard if you're just changing one person's behaviour? You lapse back into these patterns. So is that why you have to bring the whole family in?
No, not at all. I do a lot of work with individual people because maybe their family members don't want to come to see me.
Yeah.
Or they live overseas or whatever the reason is, they perhaps have died. And I can absolutely do a lot of work with one person and have them make behavioural changes, which affects everybody else positively.
Right. So what do you tell them if they were, say they were the angry person and that they would always behave in that way and get that role? So you help them to not be angry when they go back into that family. And how do they maintain that? When everybody's freaking out, you're not playing that role anymore. You were used to you being this and now everything's off kilter and we all feel a bit weird.
Well, I educate them on, you know, what might happen in the family and what the reactions might be, and we talk about that. And, of course, it's a long process. It's not a short one session.
It doesn't just click in one when you go back home and you've got it all sorted.
No. Right. It's really you have to be quite conscious to make these changes and be aware of people's discomfort around change. And some people are up for that and other people are not so much so.
Yeah. You're on Nightlife and we're talking about systemic family therapy. My guest is Jacqueline McDermott. If you have played a role in a family and you've tried to step out of it and you've done something differently, or perhaps you've taken part in this sort of therapy and you have a story to tell us about it, or perhaps you're aware of what kind of role you play in a family, you can give us a call if you want to take part in this conversation. 1300 800 222 is the number, 1300 800 222. The text line is 0467 922 702. Is this ringing true for any of you? Are you the peacemaker in the family or the entertainer? I've got a friend who, within her family, whenever she goes home, she just entertains the whole time. She's basically tap dancing the whole night long when they go out for a family dinner or something. But if she doesn't do that, everyone just sits there in silence. That's worse, isn't it? Like, to break that pattern, it can be scary.
It can be scary. And then there are, of course, the people who are the heroes, you know, that who kind of are wheeled out at the family functions because they've succeeded in things. And so, there can be lots of roles that can be very hard to come back from.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have the old scapegoat in there too. I think most people recognise a scapegoat where you're the one that's always the troublemaker.
The troublemaker.
Yeah.
Well, is that the worst role of all to be, do you think,
I think that's the hardest role for a lot of people.
Yeah, because families set their mind. That's who you are and that's what you are.
Yeah.
And that feeds back into you again, that's what I am. That's all that I am.
Mm.
I'll play that role in life as well as in the family.
Not necessarily in life, but certainly feeling like they are just trouble for the family or they don't fit with the family or everything's their fault. And really it might just be the wrong fit for the family.
Do you sometimes say, just get out of that family, don't go back, it's too hard? It's a big call.
No, I don't, Sarah.
Yeah.
No, because unless there's abuse, you know, I do need to say that because that's important for people to hear, that if there is abuse or somebody is being particularly it's toxic and you need to make your own decisions with a therapist around that. But apart from that, if it's about communication and roles and those kind of things, then there is always hope and work to be done. And people need to be connected to their family.
Mm, yeah. And it's not done out of cruelty often, this kind of thing, is it? This settling into roles and the way that the family works. Families aren't even aware they're doing it.
No, parents don't set out to be cruel to their children, mostly. You know, they're well-intended and things happen. The wheels fall off along the way.
Yeah, yeah. And so in terms of that, Bowen says that there's this sort of interdependence within a family. It's a survival mechanism that we've evolved. Why have we kind of evolved this? Is it about the family being such a strong and powerful unit for the human race? It's been a foundation of our success.
I don't think that we're not creatures that are meant to be by ourselves. We like being connected to others and our families are really important to us. And I think all of us, we all have a story to tell around our family.
Mm. Okay. So what does it mean though, you talk about in this sort of therapy about separating your thoughts from your feelings? Is that a big part of it, how we feel about our family compared to how we think when we're amongst them?
That's more around being conscious about your behaviour and what might be going on. Like where, say you're looking at your parents' behaviour and you feel disappointed about that or upset about that, that's asking people to think about where that might have come from for them or to think about it in a different way. So it's, again, it's not leading with feelings, which is that emotional reactivity.
Thinking about your parents as people.
And often I ask people to start naming their parents with their names as opposed to mum and dad, and to really get them to think about that they're not just a parent. They have their own struggles and their own flaws.
That's a big moment in life, isn't it, when you can realise that.
Mm.
You go, oh, my gosh, they weren't just on the planet to serve me.
Mm. Yeah.
Their own issues in life and their own troubles and families of their own. Our number's 1300 800 222 if you'd like to take part. If you want to put your headphones on, we've got a call actually from Diana on this. So she's got something to say to us. Hello, Diana.
Oh, hello. Good evening and hello, Jacqueline. Interested in your discussion, as I've come from a social work background and I know of systemic family therapy and et cetera. But wonderful. I just want to make a comment about twins and twins' identity and individuation. And I found being brought up my whole life with twins of the same gender, more so with identical. I'm a fraternal twin. But the way that you're spoken of in the collective, how are the twins and twin D and twin C, or, you know, during your life, your school and what have you. And I think I've had problems over many years of individual identity. And so now I get on my soapbox and talk to all the parents of twins and friends of my daughters who have had twins to say, please, you know, ask people to refer to the twins by name as individuals and not, you know, the collective.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if, Jacqueline, you had any comment about any experience you may have had with twins or whether this sort of resonates with, you know, makes sense, basically.
It absolutely makes sense. I think these days there's more of a move to differentiate between twins, which is fantastic. I think that's very hopeful.
Oh, Diana, are you still
there? Yes, I'm here.
Sorry, you faded out a bit. See, we all have this fantasy about the twin thing. It's something we all wanted to be, but there's this whole other side of it. Yeah. Do you think we're getting better at that? We're dressing them less the same and sending them to different schools and different classes. Is that an awareness of what Diana's talking about?
I think parents are just generally more aware of all children being different and needing to be different and so on. But I absolutely do understand how, you know, in previous generations, that would have been a big problem with identity, for sure.
Yes. Well, I had school friends actually who had twins actually sort of write to me and say that from observing the dynamics, you know, and what happened with us, that they deliberately chosen, you know, separate classes and this kind of thing. Anyway, it was just something that I'd like to bring up, and for any parents of twins that haven't considered this as an issue.
Yeah, but Diana, so for you, when did it get? I mean, when did you get to the point where you felt you struggled with individuation, you say, and forging your own identity? At what stage was that, and what stage did it get easier?
Oh, well, that's difficult. Probably more so when we, you know, when he left school. And interestingly enough, when I was too young to do my university course, so I stayed on an extra year. And I had developed quite an anxiety problem in that year, the first year of our separation.
Right.
And so looking back, you know, later on in life, looking at this kind of thing. I think it definitely had a big effect on my, another factor was the demand that there is on the mother, the parents, well, the mother primarily, on meeting the needs of twins, and if you know you've got busy husbands and all that kind of thing, that it's so that I'm very much focused on, you know, early experience, childhood experience in shaping issues that you can have later on, And certainly being one of a twin in those early years, you know, as an added dimension to it.
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. Thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's interesting because I've got a couple of different friends with twins, and they're very much trying to take them out separately and have their own experiences because they do seem to be really aware of this.
Mm. I'm wondering what Diana's twin thinks about it as well.
Yes, we had the same issues. I mean, this is the other thing. You can have people in the same family respond really differently to the family dynamic, can't you?
Absolutely. We have Diana who's had this anxiety in response to this identity crisis, really, and maybe her twin's not feeling this way at all.
So what's going on there? That's just the role of the individual or how the family system impacts on the individual?
Maybe it's a bit of both.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. All right. I mean, what are some case studies that you've looked at that really have explained this well? A separated couple with children with behavioural issues you've talked about.
Oh, look, there's lots of different case studies, but the case study that I was going to speak about tonight is a separated family, which I see a lot of these days, unfortunately. And in this particular case, one of the children, who is actually a twin as well, he was showing signs of anxiety and running away at home and disengaged at school and lots of behavioural issues, you know, fighting and with his sibling and so on. And so the school counsellor said, it's time you all went to family therapy. And so typically what happens, one parent engages the family therapist and the other one's a little bit more reluctant. That's quite common. And so they both did come with a step-parent as well. So in the family therapy, I try and get as many parents as I can. So that includes step-parents. In fact, the more people I have in the room, the better it is because I get more information about what's going on in the family and the wider system. Mm. And so they were all invited in. And I was able to ask each of them what their concerns are and how they sort of, you know, how they positioned the problem themselves, how they saw it. And with that information, I could then plan out how I was going to work with a child, because often when a child has behavioural issues, they're symptoms of other things that are going on in the family. And in this example, this child was showing anxiety in these behaviours, but in actual fact, there was a lot of conflict between his separated parents and he wasn't managing that conflict very well.
Oh, it's a lot for a kid to manage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he wasn't managing different parenting styles. So part of my work is helping people to get on the same parenting page, manage their conflict, manage transitions between homes, work with children to sort of, and the school. So I've had to do a lot of work with the school as well.
Mm. That's hard, isn't it? That consistency, because everybody parents differently. And when you have mixed families and after separation and then new partners come in, it can really highlight the big differences and that can be very confusing for a kid. So does that sort of complicate the family dynamic?
It absolutely does. And basically your system gets wider and wider because you're adding in other people, and other people have their own genograms, you know, their family trees and their own, you know, flaws that come
more
from
and more
that.
Complicated.
So it becomes more and more complicated, and before we know it, we're dealing with multiple issues.
Mm.
And this is what's sort of going on these days. I mean, it makes it very interesting work, and we've got very colourful families, but we also have more complicated families.
So it is more complicated these days. And so when you're choosing, okay, we've all got to get on the same page about how we deal with something, which one do you choose? Because everybody's got, oh, you know, you're just mollycoddling that kid, or, you know, oh, be kind, you're just being too strict. And how do you choose one? How do you bring them to agree on a different other style they can all implement?
Yeah, well, basically I do listen to what everybody has to say because everybody has something to contribute. And then I need to pull it together myself, which is the work. And that's where I might look at go back to the genogram and start to look at what else is happening here. What are people bringing into the room? What is the anxiety that's in the, you know, what's that about?
Do you find that people are often parenting in a way that is a response to how they were parented? So if they grew up in a very strict family, can they be very lenient or vice versa? Do we often just follow the same patterns, or can we sometimes completely do the opposite of how we were brought up because we didn't like it, perhaps?
I think people do both. They sometimes they do the opposite, which can be problematic, and other people just follow and say, this is the way I was brought up and I'm quite happy. Discipline's an example of that.
Yeah, big one.
I was smacked, you know, so I'm going to smack. And that can be, that can cause big issues if you're with a partner who doesn't want to smack, for example. So I see a lot of that.
Yeah, I'll bet. All right, Elizabeth's given us a call on 1300 800 222. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi. I'm just ringing up to try and basically represent all those survivors of abuse, of childhood abuse, because I am one. And just want to try and say that, like, people need to actually listen to the children when they try to put across what's happening to them and not try and sweep it under the carpet, because I've 20 years later gone through a lot, and because my parents at the time decided to sweep it under the carpet and none of my family were aware of it, none of my extended family were aware of it, I've basically been cut off by them, and I've had to legally cut myself off from my mother and eldest biological brother, and which means I now have no contact with my dad, who was basically my rock growing up, because he would look after me when he could. But people need to actually listen when children say that somebody has been hurting them and things like that, and not ignore them.
You've got to listen to and believe the children, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
I couldn't agree more, Elizabeth. And unfortunately, I see a lot of cases like yours where somebody eventually does say, and maybe they're not believed, or people choose to cut them off, and it's incredibly isolating, awful.
So is it about also giving kids a safe space to be able to speak and be believed? That is Elizabeth's. Yeah.
Teachers try, and counsellors all try. Like, I've been in and out of counselling and a psychology and everything else for the past 24 years, but it's a case of, it's more that, like, families try to, like, close ranks, and it's a case of keeping secrets, locking the closet on secrets, actually does nobody any good in the long run.
Mm, yeah.
Because telling a child to not speak about what's being done to them actually does more harm in the long run, because it's like you lock it down and you try and throw away the key, but you can't lock it away and throw away the key, because that does further damage. If you can't talk about it, if you can't talk it out and comprehend it, it does a lot of damage.
Mm. Yeah.
Yep.
Secrets is a huge thing, I'm imagining. It's toxic. Thanks so much for your call, Elizabeth. I really appreciate it. A secret's just totally toxic to family systems and family therapy.
They absolutely are. And Elizabeth's talking about, I mean, it's so, we've got a long way to go in this particular arena. And sadly, I see so much of, so many Elizabeths, really, where people have been cut off or not believed, or people are trying to, you know, push the secret back down again. So, and the damage is long lasting. It's awful.
Yeah.
So what Elizabeth's really talking about is that families need to, you know, start getting up with the idea that we can't hold these secrets. We need to support people when they say these things and they disclose it.
Yeah, as we said in the beginning, it's hard and you've got to be very brave, but ultimately it's very important to be done if there's an issue there. Yeah. But we do, I mean, secrets is another pattern that families follow. We have families that are very secretive and try and hold information and not share anything because they see it's a sign of weakness, and then other families are very open.
Absolutely. We actually have a concept called closed system and open system.
Right.
And the closed systems are the families that don't, they're very private and everything's sort of behind doors. You wouldn't go to your neighbour and say, I've got a problem. You keep everything in you know, between your own walls. And then the open systems are the ones with loose boundaries the other way, everybody knows everything, so we can actually identify those closed and open systems.
Right. And yeah. What do you get when you get someone from a closed family marrying someone from an open family?
We get a big problem, Sarah, often because you know, we've got maybe somebody with very loose boundaries who talks about openly about the money they earn and what, you know, what's happening with this and all sorts of things, intimacy, and there's somebody else who finds that mortifying. Yeah. Can cause a lot of problems.
Got to meet in the middle.
Yeah.
Semi-open.
Yeah. Semi-open's good. A little bit of privacy, good boundaries.
Yes, good boundaries, right.
But being able to go for help when you need help.
Yeah, okay. So in terms of that case study you were talking about, what plan did you set up for that family to ensure that everybody was on the same page and how did that impact on the child's behaviour in the long run?
So I had to do a lot of work with the parents, both individually and in the room together, because, of course, they're separated and having them together all of the time can also be problematic. And to give them some privacy with their own individual things that we're bringing into the mix, and to help them with strategies to manage the behaviour. And so there's usually a mix of a whole lot of things that come together, working with the school, you know, helping them sort of, you know, maybe some work around the actual anxiety for the child as well and the other siblings in the family. So it's quite complicated work. There's usually a few other professionals involved.
Mm. Okay. Mm. So I mean, how do you judge whether you're successful in this sort of therapy where you're involving the whole family?
Basically, because the symptomatic person in the family, for example, that child I was talking about, the symptoms reduce. He's sleeping better, he's going to school, he's doing his schoolwork, he's a happier kid. When he comes to see me, he reports that he's happy and his parents are, you know, everything's going well.
Yeah. And I'm imagining that if that's that one individual's reporting happier outcomes, I'm imagining given that he's within a family and a family system, that it has an impact on the whole family. So it's not, you might go to family therapy for one kid, but it has, or one person, has bigger impacts around the family?
Absolutely. So his twin is benefiting. You know, there are other people that are benefiting in the family because there's big changes for everyone.
Yeah.
And in actual fact, the stress is really reduced and the parents feel supported. And that's important. It's important that they don't feel judged, that they're actually supported to do the work that they need to do. It's hard.
Yeah. I mean, these sort of cracks often or systems don't even show till later in life. Sometimes when a parent dies, it can show all the sort of roles in a family because that parent who keeps it all together, everyone just suddenly realises the role they've been playing. Is it ever too late to change that? I mean, it must be easier when someone's young.
I believe it's never too late, and what I'm delighted about these days is I'm seeing more and more older people come in to do the work. So I have a lot of people in their 70s and beyond who make contact with me and say, Jacqueline, we've got some problems with our adult children or something else is happening or we've lost somebody or whatever it is. We would like to come and see you and work on our family. I think it's wonderful.
It's never too late.
Never too late.
Wow. Amazing. Yes, sometimes these things can take a lot of getting around to. And can you do it without a family? If an individual comes to see you, can they do this work without changing their family but still changing themselves within how they operate within a family?
Absolutely. And as I said, there are some times that they can't come in with people. Maybe the people won't come in with them,
yeah.
A sibling or someone like that who's angry and I'm not going in to see a family therapist. It's your problem.
Deal with it.
Yeah, but I can actually work out some strategies and different ways of communicating and we get round it in other ways.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about this tonight because we do always operate within a family system and you can always think of examples, can't you, about how your family operates and what impact it's had on you. And I think it's another thing about why people are looking into their family history. There's a big focus on this at the moment, people looking into their genealogy. And I wonder if a part of that's about tracking down who they are because of where they come from and the families they come from. It's often got signs in there, don't you reckon?
Yeah, absolutely. We're fascinated, aren't we, by our own families and where we come from and where we belong. It's because we want to be connected and it's part of our identity.
Very much so. Thanks so much. Great to chat to you.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've been chatting to Jacqueline McDermott. She is a practitioner of systemic family therapy. I don't know why I said systematic. I wanted to add an extra little couple of letters in there tonight, but she has a private practice in Sydney. Sydney Couple and Family Specialists is where she works, and she's a practitioner of this. I find it really fascinating. Thank you so much.
On ABC Radio, it's Nightlife with Sarah McDonald.